For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
So, good morning, Bodhisattvas, spring dragons in the dirt, in the clouds, and we're in the middle of some things, in the middle of our householder ongo or spring practice commitment period, a time of intensive community practice, and I think this begins week number 5 of 8 weeks. So, in the middle of things. And I can feel there's a rising energy in the temple and in the Sangha. I walked in the other day and there was a brand new, beautiful bookcase donated by Jonathan, and our library is starting to take a little bit of shape, so that's really wonderful. And there's a new statue donated by Susan Schoenbaum that is a Kuan Yin carved out of wood, of hibiscus wood from Bali. So there's this energy, you know, outside the Zendo. Spring is here. Tulips, daffodils, hyacinths are blooming in the backyard. I just saw a few viburnum. So if you exit, when you exit, you might take a little sniff or whiff of the garden. And some lilac bushes look like they're about to burst in a week or so. They're waiting for the conditions to arise. The Easter bunny, and if anybody saw the Easter bunny in the backyard, it was a backyard bunny. And so there are signs of shift. Yesterday, our Shuso, Paula, and Benji led a crew of earnest workers. Let's see, I think David Weiner and Nina and Yana were all here spiffing up our Zendo so everything's nice and clean, spring cleaning. So thank you to everyone who's contributing to this great energy. And I think the Shuso still meeting with people for tea.
That's correct.
In the practice period. If you really feel, if you're not in the practice period and you feel a little left out, talk to the Shuso.
We'll rope you in.
Hope you heard that. You'll be roped in. So we've kind of moved on from the teachings of Joko Bapp for this past couple weeks, and we're still unfolding some of the teachings of Blanche Hartman. But I didn't know if anyone has any questions so far or comments about the practice commitment period. There's a lot of different things going on for those of you here. If you do, something comes up, you know where to find me. info@ancientdragon.org. So I would like to continue exploring the life and teaching of our great Dharma ancestor, Blanche Hartman. And just to recap, sorry for those of you who've already heard this too many times, but Blanche Hartman passed away in 2016 at age 90. And she began practice in 1969 at midlife. You know, she's already a mother And over her years, she became a grandmother and a great-grandmother. And she practiced, I think, beginning like in 1969 at Berkeley Zen Center, which is affiliated with San Francisco Zen Center, and then met Suzuki Roshi and started practicing and lived and taught at San Francisco Zen Center for decades through difficult times and not as difficult times. She was known, and her husband, she and her husband both lived at San Francisco Zen Center, kind of like Cub Scout leaders or den parents or something like that. And Blanche was abbess, first female kind of abbess, co-abbess of San Francisco Zen Center from 1995 to 2003. And she was also loved, revered, and feared sometimes as a teacher of the sewing of Buddha's robe. Of these garments, some people have rock shoes on. David Ray and Howard have rock shoes. And so, so Blanche carried on that tradition, you know, each stitch in these garments, we take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, throwing ourselves into the house of Buddha. And Blanche transmitted that practice, warm hand to warm hand. And her life was a huge warm heart to warm heart. She welcomed everyone. So Easter and the energy of spring daffodils brought to mind this morning in this body, corpus, of the lines in Seeds for a Boundless Life, which is a compilation of jet set of Blanche's teachings put together by her great student, Senju. And Blanche said, the work of the daffodil preparing to bloom is very quiet. Just to look outward to see if it's doing it right. It comes, it finds this bloom within itself somehow. It comes from the very nature of the bulb. This bloom that we see is beautiful. This morning I was kind of thinking of you as like little bulbs on your cushions. I don't kind of look a little bulb-like, especially if you're wearing robes. And she says, this blooming comes from the very nature of the bulb. This bloom we see as beautiful. It's beautiful from the beginning. It's completely there. It just needs the conditions around it to help it bloom. In, this is still Blanche's, these are still Blanche's words, in Zen practice centers and teachers provide the conditions to help Buddhas bloom. So it's also the Buddha bulbs under cushions, right? It's really all here, says Blanche. It's all completely present, right with you from the beginning. So even if you don't feel that way, your little Buddha bulb isn't bothered. And she says, this is our faith. In faith that we are Buddha, we enter Buddha's way. Somehow think I would call that line from the ordination line. In faith that we are Buddha, we enter Buddha's way. In faith, we can bloom fully in the most appropriate way we practice this practice. These are Blanche's words. So I think Blanche saw everyone on their cushions as little daffodil, little Buddha bulbs, maybe, who under the right conditions flower. It's hard to believe the world as it is right now is the right condition to flower. But actually, in practice, we learn to flower under all conditions, kind of like maybe a cactus flowering in the desert. know. But we also, in our temple, in our cloud temple, in our practice together, we are creating these conditions for each other. And each of the Dharma teachers that we're reading for this practice period, each one offers some clues about these, how to create these conditions that promote blooming, or you could say Buddha-ing. The conditions for showing up in the world authentically with true compassion, that actually is our birthright, our true nature, a birthright that the Supreme Court is not going to bother with, but this is our practice. These teachers say that the conditions of a life of wholeness and kindness and authenticity are always right here in this moment, but we might miss this moment. No. Blanche was a little soft in her delivery, but it's no less clear and maybe no less disciplined for sure than Joko Beck's. Some people are like, Joko's like always kind of like, you're caught in self-centered stuff. Where's the good stuff? You know, where's the bloom? And Blanche might have been, oh, everybody's blooming. But then she's like, sit on your cushion and look at your life. And Blanche goes on to say, the spirit of our practice is to practice without trying to acquire anything because we already have what we need. Now, in parentheses, how do we know that we're trying to acquire something? And where do we fall short in really feeling that we have everything that we need in this moment? What is the right wisdom and understanding of this? We have everything we need in this moment, yet we stand up in our lives for the things that seem to matter in an appropriate time and place. So we're not just like, hey, I've got everything I need, so I don't care about the world. That's not a practice. But how do you find that place? Where is that place where you have everything, where you're completely whole in this moment? Actually, it's right here, right now. But then again, what gets in the way? Kind of smoke gets in our eyes, you know? Blanche goes on to say, without trying to be anything other than just this one, or is it this one? Because just this one is a Buddha from the beginning. You know that she's gone, just Blanche Hartman. I think she's speaking every single thing. It's Buddha from the beginning. And we practice to express and realize and settle on the suchness of this one so that it can manifest in whatever activity we undertake, so that our oneness with all beings become evident. And Blanche asks, can we do it? Can we make it happen? And her advice is, just sit. Just sit. Now, our just sitting, of course, is not limited to being on the cushion, but this is a good place for us to start to learn how to create these conditions so that the suchness of our oneness manifests in every activity. Just sit, just be willing to be here as this one and allow what arises to come out. Be willing to be just this one. Can we just sit zazen, not judging whether we're doing it right or wrong? Just practice knowing the body. You know, somebody was telling me that a great Zen practitioner, actually a Dharma era Blanche's, once said while smoking a cigarette, I guess practice is really just about being able to stand who you are. Can you stand yourself? But also, can we stand true suchness? The beauty of the daffodils, the horror of somebody being put on a plane and dumped in a prison in a foreign country. Can we stand the love and the hate? You know, it takes a lot of sitting to be able to open to all of it. And then to act from this place of wholeness. So, I could stop here. It's really enough for one morning. So I'm wondering if it makes sense, if it could be helpful to go on. So you can stop me if it's too much already. You know, but I keep wanting to offer, to share how amazing and deep Blanche is in our life and in our lineage. And some people would say things like, "Oh, Blanche, you know, her dharma is a little light when she gives dharma talks, but she really teaches when she sews." And that thought might have crossed my mind 20 plus years ago. But as I read her writing, her words, almost nothing in this Seeds from a Boundless Life, or Seeds for a Boundless Life, or Boundless Life, compilation of Blanche's writings. She almost says nothing about sewing in here directly. And I think her dharma was vast and wide as it could possibly be. So I'll share just a little more, maybe a lot more, maybe too much more. So she commented, so somehow, like, she wrote an advice column for Shambhala Sun or Tricycle or something, but she also wrote some other things in this book called The Hidden Lamp, which many of us know because it's one of the few documentations of stories of awakened Buddhist women, female-bodied individuals. It's almost like a little Bible. It's like, oh my gosh, the women in Zen. But may there be all genders represented widely and vastly in the future. But right now we have the lamp. And Blanche commented on a teaching story in this, and I was kind of surprised at what I'm sure she chose to comment on. So here's the story. And in the story, so it's this Hidden Lamp is a collection of teaching stories that are then have commentaries on those teaching stories by contemporary Buddhist women. And in this story, Blanche speaks to the issues of feeling our life force fully and unhindered and knowing the Dharma throughout the body. So here's the story. An old woman in China supported a monk for many years. She built him a hermitage and provided him with food and clothing. It's like, imagine somebody living out back in the garage, you know. After 20 years, she wondered what he'd attained. You know, been mooching off me for 20 years. I think I'll test him. And so she sent a beautiful girl from the village, young woman, to the hermit. This monk hermit, and said, you know, embrace him and ask him how he felt. So the girl goes to the hut, and caresses this monk. I don't know what the monk was doing, facing the wall, you know. And she caresses him and says, "How do you feel just now?" That's a great question to ask anybody, right? How do you feel just now? And the monk says, "A withered tree on a cold boulder has no warmth in winter." Kathy's cracking up over here. The girl returned to the old woman and reported back. "What?" said the old woman. "To think I've been supporting an imposter all these years." She grabbed a stick, hurried to the hermitage, beat the monk, shouting, "Get out of here!" And she burned the hermitage to the ground. Imposter, right? After all these years of practice, all you've got is a withered tree? Who's a blooming? Give me a break, you know? So this old woman, you know, in this story, one way to read this, there's so many ways, of course, is she reacts to the denial of the body, the denial of sexuality, the denial of life. And also, there's a little bit of a, like, you know, I'm just this withered old, not even old, probably, what, start of 20s, maybe only 40. So there's still a little energy left, you know. Felt constricted to this old woman. And, you know, our zazen is all-inclusive and free, so it can't wiggle out of desire. As Blanche commented on this story, her comments are great. She starts out, "I think the monk in this koan, this teaching story, is totally off base in his attempt to squelch his human feelings, in his efforts to shut down rather than celebrate human feeling." Ehe Dogen describes enlightened beings as, quote, having few desires. But I don't think that having few desires means suppressing feeling. For me, it means just being aware of all that we have to be grateful for, and thereby knowing we don't need anything more. I would say we don't need to extract anything extra. I think, how might Joka Beck? I'd love to hear her comment on this story. But what gets in the way of gratitude and authenticity? As kind as Blanche was, you know, she could be scrupulous and careful about practice and about facing your life in this moment, in reality, and your actions, without pretense. I used this example before, but I'll repeat it again. When I was sewing my black okesa, my black robe with Blanche, before I had this one, you know, I went to Blanche. "Should I take this stitch out? It's not, it looks not quite as good as those others, you know." And she sensed immediately, "Yeah, you can. But you know, Lori, you can't redo your life." Mm-hmm. That's it. "Thank you, Blanche. Thank you for seeing how I was trying to get something from selling this robe. And I was trying not to look at the flaws in my stitching, right? Wiggle out of it." So Blanche, in her commentary, goes on. She says, "Through Zen practice, we develop a greater and greater appreciation of everything around us. We don't become an old, withered stump." Blanche says, "I'm much more alive than I was when I started this practice, and much more appreciative." And that's true of most Zen people I know. And she knew a lot. She lived among Zen for decades. So this practice is not about suppressing desire or destroying our humanity, but allowing it to flow out to everything rather than to a particular object. She goes, I met Zen practice through Suzuki Roshi, through Katagiri Roshi, and Sojin Mel Weitzman. And these were not withered trees. They were very lively people. In every photo I have of Suzuki Roshi, and I have a lot of them, he's laughing or smiling. You ever notice this? Like, it seems like it was maybe kind of hard for him to look too stern, you know? My teachers and my practice have never taught me not to enjoy life. The deeply seasoned teachers I've had the opportunity to meet have all been supportive to people who are suffering. So they meet suffering, but they're also playful and lighthearted. You know, so I'm encouraging this. You know, isn't it wonderful to have this teaching, to be playful and lighthearted? You know, buoyancy and joy are qualities of years of practice, deep practice, and cannot be faked. It's not a kind of intoxicated joy or a playfulness that's trying to distract people from difficulty. But this idea of the aloof, uptight Zen student, and I've had my share of years of trying to embody that. This idea is disrupted and burnt down. You know, this pretense of self-involved purity. I'm free of desire. This is burnt down. Perhaps this hermit monk was really trying to be good, you know, to try to set a boundary and follow the Buddhist precept of not misusing sexuality or sexual desire. And Blanche, in her commentary, does acknowledge the precepts, but as guideposts with some warnings, which I think are really great. You know, our precept not to do harm, to benefit all beings, to embrace and sustain all beings, not to misuse desire. Blanche says, I understand the precepts not as rules to follow, but more as be very careful in this area of human life because there's a lot of suffering there. So pay attention to what you're doing. She says, like a sign on a frozen pond that says, danger, thin ice. We are walking on thin ice, Bodhisattvas. Rather than shame on you. So we might hear shame, you know, if we're holding on to our ego often. But really, the precepts are not like getting you to be good or better. They're just a way to live on thin ice that we're always walking on. Blanche goes on and says, our vow is to help people end suffering, not add to their suffering. I feel that there is a way to live without objectifying anyone as a sexual object while still appreciating their beauty. This is living by the precepts. So this old woman with her fire and her stick, you know, she was teaching this hermit monk. She could sense he was maybe objectifying both himself and the young woman. She burned down this house of this pretense of some great attainment of withering away all desire. And maybe with the hut completely burnt and homeless, this hermit will seek the heat of life and feel his body. Maybe he'll even dance and sing. Put my right hand down, whole body in, and I shake it all about. You know, maybe this monk will do something like that. Surprise this young woman. The true imposter effect, you know, is being caught in ideas about who we are or who we should be. And who others are and who they should be. And this old woman sensed that the monk might have been caught in something about the young woman in her embrace. And the true person of the way responds appropriately and lovingly to each moment. And Blanche ends with, I love the image of loving everyone the same. Now, generally speaking, we kind of don't want to love everyone the same. And we don't want to be loved the same, you know. Like, I want to be more adored than this yourself. Sorry. Maybe just a little less ego, like sandpaper, you know? So this is how we are. Once we admit that, then we can let go of it. So Blanche says, that's something I've taken on. So she recommends a practice, you know? Taken on myself to love everyone the same, to love everyone completely. It's not about withering our perception or appreciation of the world around us. It's becoming more and more appreciative of the world around us, its beauty, all it has to offer us, and our total connection with it. And then this story, this commentary in the Hidden Land ends with a couple of questions that I thought are pretty good. Can the pain of desire be meditated away? What can you do with desire that you can either fulfill or eliminate when you're really caught? And I'll say, can you be playful and loving without trying to control the moment or others? And have you ever really loved and appreciated someone unconditionally without conditions, or been loved without conditions? How does that feel in the body? So maybe this is enough for me this Easter morning. Little Bodhisattva bunnies, thank you all very much. And would anyone like to offer some comments? In the room or in the cloud on anything that I brought forth or anything you'd like to bring forth. Ah, Niozan. Maybe Niozan needs a mic. So we're learning this new practice with better sound, but a little effort. Thank you, Niozan.
Thank you, Hogesu. Thank you, Shizu. All you guys get sorted out over there. I very much take the point that you're making about Blanche's teaching, and I really appreciate it. What would this call on? You mentioned the specter of the uptight, unresponsive Zen student, but of course, that has a flip side, right? And that flip side has been expressed in this country by a good number of teachers winding up being asked to leave their communities. The monk doesn't get any redos, but I hear this story and it really strikes me as very much one of these, you know, answer yes, 30 blows,
yep.
Answer no, 30 blows.
Mm-hmm.
So I would like to ask you, if anything comes to mind, what might have been a more complete or open or wholesome response from the monk?
There are many. And this same response could have been a wholesome response. Not sure. But Yeah. There's so many things I could say, but this monk could have just laughed and said, that feels so good. And now, why don't you sit down and have a cup of tea with me? You could have inquiry and say, I was surprised that you embraced me. Was there something you're needing? No. Or it could have been like, this is too much for me. I'm an old geezer, you know. There could have been many different things. And it, like I said, it could have been in a certain situation, this could have been the response. I think for the convenience of this teaching story, the old woman was trying to make a point, right? Now, Niozan, I think when you say teachers being basically kicked out of their community for sleeping with their students, which has been kind of a pandemic in Zen communities. I think I spoke about this before, that we protect the Dharma, and the more sensitive we are to the impact of our actions, you really have to look at it, you know? And I think that Joko was a great example of someone who saw this kind of nonsense of inappropriateness in a Zen center and was like, you know what? There's always some more work to be done. So the flip side of this is we're walking on thin ice, or I like to say we're fast, loose, and out of control. So we need some restraint. You know, the practice period itself in Japanese is they use this term to refer to the practice period as within restraint. So there's these rules, you know, like people make commitments on your commitment sheets. How are you doing with that? You know, honestly, you know, have you fulfilled what you even, you self-committed to things, you know? And so I think there is a sense of it's very easy to go off track. So, Suzuki's comment on the 30 blows was something like, it is very difficult to meet each moment completely fully, you know? So being aware of this, we're careful. Anybody in recovery programs knows, like, so easy to slip up. And you know what happens when that happens. So, but this is even easy in small ways in life. You know, like, oh, I'm not sure if that trash can was for the compost, for the recycling, or for, you know, landfill. Just I'll casually throw something anywhere, right? So I don't feel like really asking or thinking that through. So that's just a small example. But like I notice, like I'm always like, wow, like there's all this like trash and recycling and the trash, and then I get through it, you know. And then people, if I say something, somebody's like, well, they're not labeled properly, right? So this is how this all starts. And so I think as a teacher, you're under even more obligation to pay attention to things and to be open to feedback and also question. If there's a question about an activity, about a response, run it through the precepts. So this monk could have said, Niozan, I ran this through the precepts, and somehow I feel great desire for you, and I don't want to act on it because I'm afraid it could hurt both of us. Mm-hmm. How's that?
Pretty good.
How about you?
No, thank you. But I'm sitting over there someday.
Matthew Bodhisattva.
Thank you. with Nyosan's question, it raises the point that there have been a lot of scandals in Zen by men. And the story is a story of a wise woman saying, "Ooh, I don't trust this answer from a man who is telling himself a story about his non-reactivity. That doesn't sound trustworthy." And so I don't have a clear question, but I wonder if, like, last week you referred to Blanche's Dharma sometimes as like a grandmother Zen. And I wonder if you could say something about, and maybe this goes to the precepts, like, what is it about this practice body that you see as the wisdom as we focus on our women ancestors, when clearly when the precepts hit the road, there are differences in remembering those in our embodiment in this community.
You mean in our gendered embodiment?
Yes.
Oh, you know, I think that those in power and privilege have a harder time seeing what goes on. Mm-hmm. And at some point, old women don't care a bit about that. And they can just speak their truth, you know. That's one thing I have to say. But I do think that there is something about the more power and privilege one has, the less able one is to see how they're impacting others. And it just so happens that, you know, in particular, white, male, cisgendered straightness has kind of tried to run the show for a long time, so it seems. But grannies, you know, grannies can make mistakes. And they might have other ways of having to look at themselves, too. So, but you could write dissertations, I'm pretty sure, about gender and Buddhism, and I hope they are written, and we learn deeply from them. Do you have anything else you'd like to add about that, Matthew? Because I know...
I'm not sure if there's but it brings up, you know, I loved the point you were saying about Blanche's Dharma errors. Essentially, this is a practice of, like, putting up with ourselves. Mm-hmm. And what is it about power, privileged identities, where it helps us not look at the parts we want to put up with, but that everybody else is having to put up with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So maybe that's what I'll sit with for more.
Yeah, thank you for that. Yeah, so it's easier to look away when you have certain kinds of privilege. It's easier to look away from someone being, you know, kidnapped and thrown on a plane and thrown into a jail, or of someone walking down the street and being harassed somehow for who they are if you're not a member of that category. So this is true, and it changes all the time, so we have to be ready for everything. But it is important to also look at these factors, and sociocultural factors. E. Bodhisattva.
Well, I just want to acknowledge that you were acknowledging Easter and the Easter Bunny. It's also the end of Passover.
Thank you.
And I went to California, and I have an old friend who teaches at Long Beach, Cal State Long Beach, and he organized a Freedom Seder Friday night, and it was and got sponsorship from the Interfaith Center on campus, and the invitation went out to everybody. He specifically invited some Muslims and Christians, and anyway, like I said, it was open to anybody, and he said, you know, there's going to be opportunities for people to bring poems and whatever they wanted to bring as their response to the present moment. And then a few days ago, they got a response that the administration was saying that the interfaith, that they weren't being inclusive enough, and there was questions about whether the interfaith office could sponsor them, and it seemed like there were people in the administration trying to shut it down.
Yeah.
And anyway, in the course of his talking about it and his listening to his colleagues, I became aware that, you know, the politics on his campus are in some respects very different from the politics on mine. But I mean, connection to, you know, the teaching story and your comments, I think, is that, create spaces where we can acknowledge our responses to the present moment and share them is, I think, something very precious and something also frankly to be fought for. Whatever ends of the political spectrum the efforts to shut discussion down are coming from, I want to create spaces and we can join together to create spaces where we can speak from our own experience of the present moment and approach it.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you, Eve. I hope we can do that with each other and the world learns to do that. Maybe so. And sometimes you just have to be like, okay, so the university won't sponsor me. I'm still going to have my party anyway.
And we did.
Yeah. Jerry Bodhisattva. There's a lot going on in the room here.
Mm-hmm. I was struck by the question. I think it's more about letting the flaws come in to you rather than shut it off at the door and say, yeah, voting for you.
And you've been helping with teas. She said, we'll have a cup of tea for you, shall you? She shall need it. Right? It's about knowing yourself. Thank you. David Ray, Bodhisattva.
Well, there's a thing I want to thank you for in your talk, and I didn't hear it in Blanche's commentary, but the empathy for this monastic practitioner who, okay, so it sounds like, you know, was using Buddhist practice to hide from his life, huh? And thinking that if he's good enough, he's just a perfect goody-goody, that somehow everything will be okay, huh?
Yeah.
And acknowledging that, wow, maybe 10 years later, he says, you know, the best thing that ever happened to me is that the woman that I was living off of came and burned my house down. Wow. Just thank you for, because it's so easy to think of, oh yeah, he's bad because he's, you know, privileged and all those things, but seeing that human life, I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, I think maybe it didn't come across in Blanche's comments in the story, but I do think that it wasn't to be mean to this monk, but also not to support and fund in a codependent way. You know, maybe he needed those 20 years in the hut to finally dance and play and sing.
Or a full burning hut to warm the log.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. How about online bodhisattvas, cloud friends? I know Tygen knows New Blanche very well. Was her Chusso? Oh, Yana.
Once again, caught on to the Stitch comment. You just love it so much. But do you ever get to the place where, okay, you when you were describing, you know, about the Stitch and Blanche's response to you, I was trying to put myself in your shoes at the time, and I know I would have, like, oh my gosh, you're so right, and I would have shamed myself. As soon as I started saying that, you started talking about the shame, like, it's not supposed to add more shame to the way that you think, because it's supposed to. So, do you ever get to that place where when you have the aha moment, when a teacher, like, when you were, you know,
pointed out my delusion?
Well, right, like, it's kind of like to me, I'm like, duh, like, no, I can't, like, why do I want this Stitch to be perfect, right? Like,
great.
So, when does the shame ever go away, I guess? like, do you ever, when you continue getting these life lessons from coming to the Dharma talks or whatnot, right? Like, they seem so profound and so, like, duh. But I don't know, but at the same time, I'm like, why didn't I know that?
Mm-hmm. Well,
and that's shame on me. Like, I shame myself for not knowing that.
So you're liberating yourself by acknowledging it.
Okay.
You're like,
thank you.
I mean, if I'm like, I'm somebody who shames myself, and somebody goes, do you still shame yourself? Yeah, I do. Where's the shame in that? Like, shame is evaporated when we admit who we are. I know, I was telling somebody something, and, you know, one time I was at a monastery, and it came time for meal service. And at some point in the chant, you reach behind and you pick up your bowls. And I'm reaching behind. No bowls. I forgot my bowls. Now, I could have been like, oh, I was too tired. Or, oh, this. Or somebody must have taken my bowls and put them back in my room. You know? But I was just like, ah, there's no bowls here. And I looked over and had a moment of perfect silent communication with the Eno. And she said, and I got up and I walked by her and she's like, you can go eat in the kitchen. I said, great, I forgot my bowls. I did not detect in the body shame at that moment, just kind of like curiosity, like, oh, I forgot my bowls. I need to do something because otherwise I will sit here. I could have sat there for the whole meal, but I was kind of hungry, so, you know. But there's something about just owning who you are, you know. Oh, I didn't do that. I missed a stitch here. And I'm always like, oh, if you miss a stitch, as long as your, you know, garment isn't going to fall apart, you missed a stitch. Everything is perfect as it is. But we forget it. We miss it. We have karmic conditioning. This is why Joko is so strong about looking at yourself, because it is deep bodhisattvas. You know, for me, I don't know, 40 years of practice, you go out the window in an instant. And when the Shuso gets more attention than I do. You know, can be something like that, some nonsense. Nonsense. So, you know, the antidote to shame is just own who you are. A beautiful daffodil bulb of a bodhisattva waiting to flower. And already the flower. Paul Kopp bodhisattva. We'll give that over to you.
So thank you, as always. I've always both liked and hated that story, I have to say. I appreciate the teaching that we draw from it about honoring other people and about our desires and not squelching them or attempting to squelch them or meditate them away. But I, just have to say. I just think it's unfair. It's a mischaracterization to say that he was mooching off. The relationship in traditional Buddhism, in fact, she was being offered more than he was, because people would support the monastery to develop merit for themselves, and this was the central practice. I'll try to turn off my inner professor here.
That's okay, go for it. Be completely the inner professor.
And it was very much a two-way thing, and so I admit I'm a bit taken aback by the idea that he was mooching off. The other thing is, he was not offered affection. He was not offered love.
Mm.
This young woman was sent.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever was happening in that moment, it was not affection and love, as we might want to think about it. So, sorry, it's just been boiling in me a little bit, and I wanted to say it.
I hope we turn down the temperature a little bit. But these are great comments because, you know, it's easy to idealize these stories. And one reason I brought this up is because I do think it's a loved and hated story. And what Paul is saying about merit, you know, is that unlike in our time and place, in Buddhism in America, people would give vast quantities of money to monks to attain merit. So in some ways, maybe that she was also burning down her own desire for merit in burning down this hut. And, you know, but this sense that accumulating merit for yourself and others was a focus in Buddhist practice, and it still is in some places in the world, you know. But this is a great point that, and I'm sorry I was a little cavalier by saying mooching, you know, this brings me back to the old days where it's good to have particular and close reading. And I'm really glad that you're here to offer that, Paul, and that you stood up and said this, because it was a little bit of a wiggling on my point to make a joke, but it's important to remember this. That this woman, every time she probably brought food to him, and when she built the hut, she was thinking, I'm closer to Buddhahood now. She didn't even have to sit zazen. Somebody else is doing it for her. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this burning down the hut, maybe she's burning down her own hut too at the same time. And it's right. This woman was sent not out of love, maybe, but like, is my merit any good? Am I really getting my money's worth out of this monk? So, we're on thin ice everywhere we go.
David Weiner had briefly raised his
David
hand.
Weiner. Is he still here?
Right.
There you are.
I raised my hand, then I put it down again.
I'm unmuted.
Am I unmuted? Can you hear me?
Maybe on our end, the seeker.
Yeah.
Is the volume up on that speaker?
Where is it?
It's that big giant thing next to you. It looks like a sidebar.
Is it?
We're still figuring out our equipment. But maybe, David, if you want to type your comment in the chat, we could also use that as well.
Right,
I don't know if it's plugged in, it's a volume on it. Your volume on the computer might need to be turned up, Matthew.
It's on the computer, it shows it fully turned up.
Okay. So that would be too complex for our technical capability. So David, maybe you could type in the chat your comment.
The output looked wrong. Let me see if this helps. Do you want to try? Do you mind speaking again, David?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, great. Matthew Wizard, thank you.
Yeah, I was put up my hand and then I took it down. But what I'm reminding of is that the practice of both the monk and the woman who is trying to get her merit were centered on themselves, not on the other. And that if the monk would have said to the young woman, what is it that you want? Why do you come here? and at least be compassionate to her. And if the woman would have realized, why did you do that? What was bothering you about that, rather than going ahead and beating him and burning down the house? That their practice was very self-centered in a way. They weren't really concerned about others. And yet I think what Buddha is trying to teach us is to care for others and to be with others. And in a sense, they're both missing a point. They're both missing a point. And the question is, what do we do in our life? Are we trying to become enlightened for our own sake, or are we trying to become enlightened or trying to be in the world that we're caring for others? Yeah. And I think that's the central question of our practice.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you.
And we fall short no matter how hard we try sometimes. And I think sometimes in Zen stories, there are extreme kind of behaviors to try to shock us out, those 30 blows of our own sense of, like, you know, whether it's complacency or grasping of some sort. So, but thank you for that comment, David. Yes. I would have been soft there.
Just a comment. Oh, yeah. I kind of appreciate sort of the live, real-time sort of enactment of a koan collection just now. Because, like, you know, like I'm realizing I love this story so much, but I'm realizing I don't actually know what traditional commentaries are for this story.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not familiar with what collections it might have been in, but if you read a koan collection, really look at some of these, like, there's commentary on commentary. The commentary is, like, making fun of the previous commentary. And it's just, like, one guy just, like, decides, like, I don't know, that guy's an idiot. Like, he got completely wrong. And it's just, like, people responding to each other over and over and over time and centuries. And it's really beautiful, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I, some of you might know that I used to practice in a tradition that was more koan-centric. And it's so funny to, like, take a look at this story and go, like, no, this is the way I want to read it. This is the way that Blanche read it. Right? And you know, I'm asking you, how do you read it? How do you read it?
Mm-hmm.
That took me back because I had this, I was given this koan like over 10 years ago. Not this and I, maybe in the last year, after sitting just in the back all the time for 10 years or more, I was like, I've been so obsessed with getting it right. For 10 years, the one single koan. I think that there's one way to read this. That it's a correct way to read this.
Mm-hmm.
I want it to be the way to read this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm wrong. Wrong entirely. And it was this like unlocking moment because I'm like, oh, me again. Got it. All right. We'll look out for that next time that shows up. It's going to pop up. And that even now is so much kinder than what it used to be.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for, and congratulations. These are the things that are hard, like, oh, I just noticed that I had this fixed idea of something. And still, we have to put our stake in the ground and attach to something, and together we kind of stir the pot. And some readings are pretty good, yeah.
I believe Taken was
good. Ah, Taken, great. Good to see you.
Hi, just to say that when I wish you so with Blanche and Tassajara way back, she was very caring and kind and playful at the same time, but she really cared for everybody in the practice period. And just to say that.
Thank you.
So, thank you.
Thank you. It must have been really great to do Shiso with her.
Yes, it was.
Especially having a very different root teacher.
It was very good, yes.
Yeah. Was it a spring or a...
It was spring. Or fall? It was spring of 1990.
Spring of 1990. Wonderful. And this is, you know, our community is in part intimately connected to that spring of 1900 and Tuggan's great practice. So thank you very much.
Just one story from that. Blanche was doing sewing down in the dining room one morning, and I was facing out, and in front of the Tassajara Zendo, there's a bed of irises. And so I had the opportunity over like three periods maybe of watching an iris open. One petal, and then another, and then eventually a third. So anyway, it was very fun.
Wonderful. So this maybe brings us full circle to spring and the bulbs and the blooming. So thank you very much, everyone. We'll chant the four vows three times and then do announcements. Is that our plan? And thank you all very much. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way.
Beings are numberless. We vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. We vow to cut through them. Dharma gates are boundless. We vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. We vow to realize it. Beings are numberless. We vow to free them. Illusions are inexhaustible. We vow to cut through them. Dharma gates are boundless. We vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. We vow to realize it. Beings are numberless. We vow to free them. Illusions are inexhaustible. We vow to cut through them. Dharma gates are boundless. We vow to enter them. The Buddha's way is unsurpassable. We vow to realize.